All right, my friends, thanks for tuning into the podcast, where, as always, we'll discuss the professional literature and the evidence-based protocol as they relate to the effective treatment of clinically significant anxiety symptoms. I'm Chris Lines, licensed psychotherapist and OCD spectrum disorders treatment specialist, and this, well, this is OCD Straight Talk. This podcast is made possible by NoCD. NoCD offers effective, affordable, and convenient OCD therapy. NoCD therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention, or ERP therapy, the gold standard treatment for OCD. With NoCD, you can do virtual, live face-to-face video sessions with one of their licensed, specialty-trained therapists, and they accept most major insurance plans. To find out more about NoCD, visit nocd.com. That's nocd.com to book a free 15-minute call. For people in the state of Kentucky, you can go to kentuckyocd.com. That's kentuckyocd.com and book a session with me. It was me sitting in an office reading dozens and dozens of peer-reviewed articles, tearing apart David Barlow's Clinical Handbook of Psychological Disorders. I mean, that bitch is like 700 pages of technical reading. You know, this is a serious graduate-level textbook. So I'm thrown in the deep end, having to unlearn all this psychodynamic bullshit that I learned well, deeply in graduate school. Well, we don't even use that language here. Here you're having to talk a completely different psychological language and think in entirely different strategic terms therapeutically. So quite literally, I'm reading these articles and David Barlow's clinical handbook, and I'm reading cover to cover a variety of evidence-based treatment manuals, working feverishly to familiarize myself with protocols so that I can be at least somewhat competent in the room and not look like a complete moron in supervision. So in any case, eventually I kind of came to this place where I was watching clinicians in the room. I had lots and lots of opportunities to watch her work. I also had opportunities to watch other clinicians work. And I began to notice styles. And I would see the difference between my clinical supervisor and maybe some other clinicians that worked for her. And of course, everybody's following the same protocol. Everybody's following the same structured process. But different people, you might say, have different ways of doing the same thing. And as long as it's executed to standard, I guess you could say, it's okay that different people have something of a different way of doing it. And maybe part of what that means is we're all teaching patients the same skills and we're following the same general format, but some people have a different way of explaining things, or some people have something of a different temperament in the process, and all that's fine. Again, as long as we're following the same structured, proven, and evidence-based process. In any case, I digress. In any case, what I'm meaning to say is I started to notice generally that patients seemed to respond better to a certain style. And kind of what that meant was clinicians who were maybe a little bit more empathic and maybe a little bit on the warmer side. You know, these are your classically trained psychodynamic talk therapists, like, well, yours truly. Patients weren't really responding as well to the, tell me more about that. They weren't responding as well to that as to, I don't really care that you're anxious. I want to see you do the technique properly, right? This is kind of like matter of fact communication of learn the technique well, do it the right way. That's going to pay dividends for you in the future. Almost more of like a football coach. No, you're doing it wrong. Put your leg here. Put your arm there. You put more of your hip into it. Get lower. So I just began to see that patients didn't mind being pushed. They didn't mind the idea of a clinical directive. As long as they had reason to believe that the person in front of them, one, is competent, Two, that person genuinely wants to help. And as time would have it, I came to interact with various family members. You know, we would do these things called IOPs, intensive outpatient program. And the IOP often involved the whole family flying in from wherever it was, and the patient being seen twice a day across the course of 14 days. And sometimes that would involve a family session here or there or whatever it might be. And clinicians would have the opportunity to interact with the families, and the families would have opportunities to watch the clinician interact with the patient. And sometimes what you'd see is the family would start to act like the therapist when the patient, him or herself, would seek reassurance or would invite some kind of physical compulsive support. The family would kind of take on this role of the therapist. And remember, good therapists, in my experience and in my opinion, good OCD therapists, they don't lean toward empathy and catharsis. They lean toward clinical directives that are proven to work. And they're not necessarily trying to wow you with their ability to listen. They're instead intending to get you results as quickly as they can get them for you. So that often looks like, no, you're not doing it the right way. Go back and do this, or stop doing that. You know, whatever it is. And maybe I'm embellishing that slightly, but I don't think a lot. Anyways, the point is the family members would start to kind of take on this gruff, less than empathic and sensitive persona because, well, that's what they see the therapist doing. And after all, they are seeing their loved one make some changes and their loved one seems to be making progress and getting better. And so, well, I'll start doing the same thing. So over time, I've had a lot of conversations with families and family members about, well, how should I respond when my loved one asks for reassurance? And these are always interesting conversations. And I think that the task before me at the present time is to try and communicate to, I don't know, a bunch of listeners whose situations, by the way, I know nothing about, some general rules, some helpful ideas. Again, not having any notion of how motivated you are to get better, as well as how severe your symptoms are, how mean-spirited, maybe you could say, your family members tend to be to begin with. Like, there's a lot of variables that, of course, are not in front of me as I'm sitting here meaning to provide some general parameters or principles to you over this podcast platform. You know, but I think that generally speaking, I encourage family members when it comes to the question of how should I respond to my loved one when she asks or he asks for reassurance. We're wanting to strike a balance between two ideas. And the first of these ideas is be loving, be supportive, be accepting. And for a lot of family members, that's hard because they've been beaten up, frankly, by the OCD-er. The OCD has taken over the house and everybody's walking on eggshells. Everybody's trying their damnedest to not piss off the OCD and the OCD-er again. You know, and so the idea of being loving and being supportive, it's like, well, we tried that for the past decade and we've had our asses handed to us at least twice a month for the entirety of that time. Not super open to being loving and supportive right now. What else you got? And I would say, well, what else I got is the other side of things. But this one side of things is important because if you abandon this one side of things and you dive headlong into the other, I think what you're going to find is an equally destructive situation, only it's on the other side. So I think that being loving and supportive, being caring, and meaning to demonstrate that love, support, and care in a meaningful way on the ground floor, that's part of what we're working to balance. That's part of the balance. I've seen situations where individuals are putting their hands on mom and dad, where they're really, really verbally aggressive, where mom and dad are not just intimidated, but they're legitimately scared, where the property gets destroyed and hands get thrown at people. You know what I'm saying? Like really ugly, really destructive situations. And so the message of, well, we need to be work And so the message of we need to be loving, it does, I think, fall on deaf ears in certain circumstances and cases. But I would nevertheless say, generally speaking, whatever we do, we're trying to balance two ideas. And the first of these is working to be loving, working to be supportive in a meaningful way, again, on the ground floor. The other side of that, though, is not engaging compulsions, right? So when the OCDer asks for reassurance, the other side of it is, well, don't provide the reassurance. And in many of these cases, not providing the reassurance is almost a surefire way to get the person all anxious and angry and aggressive and all this. And I understand that. But the truth of it is, you simply can't keep doing what you've been doing. You know, reassuring this person over and over and over, or completing mundane tasks for him or her so that he or she doesn't have to do it and thereby get, you know, the anxiety and the OCD all aggravated. You know, it's a matter of we have to be willing to try something else, but that something else isn't just like, well, go fuck yourself. You know, I'm not providing reassurance for you, motherfucker. You know, it's like, well, I mean, that's not loving. That's not supportive. It's really important that your family member hear that I'm with you. I'm for you. I'm your battle buddy. I'm your ride or die. And it's because of that, that I can't just keep providing reassurance. It's not in your best interest. It's not good for you. And so I'll not only teach patients what are called exposure statements, maybe, maybe not, I don't know, but I'll also teach family members to do that. And so when the OCDer says, well, do you think I'm dirty? Or do you think that I'm going to sexualize our child? Or do you think I'm a danger to myself or to other people? Or whatever the fear is, whatever it might be, we're responding, well, maybe, maybe not, I don't know. Or we might say, you know, I love you too much to have this conversation with you. I don't think it's good for you. You know, and maybe you need to explain to your loved one what you're doing and why you've shifted what you're saying to him or to her. You know, I'm not going to keep providing reassurance because, you know, I think that, you know, it's not really helping and I don't think it's good for you. What I'm going to start doing instead is riding the line of uncertainty, because in reality, I don't know anyway, and I don't think you do either. So let's just start there as really the most logical place to be. Maybe that's going to happen. Maybe it's not. We don't know what's going to happen, but no amount of sitting here talking about it and trying to manage our anxiety somehow is going to change the fact that we still don't really know what's going to happen. So let's embrace the uncertainty as the sort of dreaded elephant in the room and really work to stop the reassurance dance. Now, as I say that, I've seen a lot of cases through the years where family dynamics have fallen too far to one side or the other, where they've been overly accommodating, where they've really, really worked to be loving and supportive. And parents might somehow say, well, why should I punish her for having OCD? You know, and it's like, you know, and we'll have that conversation. If it's within my ability to lower her anxiety level, why shouldn't I do that? I think that that's something I should do. And so they'll be overly accommodating. And what they find over time is, well, that's not really working. But I've seen families lean too far to the other side too, where like literally you have people getting up and walking away in the middle of a conversation, right? Or shaming the OCDer for, oh, we're going to talk about this again. You know, this kind of thing where they have the right idea that we're not going to participate in the compulsive pattern, but they're doing it in such a way where they're really violating the other side of things, where it's like you're not being loving, you're being frankly destructive and mildly abusive. This isn't helpful either to the OCD or frankly to your relationship. This is not a good habit. So it's a matter of striking that balance of I'm going to be loving and I'm going to be supportive. I'm going to demonstrate that I'm here. I'm walking with you, but it's not good for you that I keep doing this. So I'm going to try to stop doing this. And my response instead, lovingly, is going to be, well, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. Well, I don't know if you're facing this or that. I don't know if you're dirty, or I don't know if you're one day going to sexualize a child. I mean, I guess that might happen, but maybe it won't. I don't know. Do you? You know, and it's like, well, fuck no, dude, I don't know. Well, I guess we'll walk through it together, right? And so now the OCDers having to face these thoughts without at least that particular compulsive pattern. And hopefully he or she can continue that effort and wrestle some of the motor compulsions into submission as well. And over time, as you know, bleeding this system dry of compulsive responses, that's really going to begin to reduce the severity of that system. And you, the family member, can participate in that particular piece of things when you say, well, I'm going to be loving, but in the process, I'm not going to help to engage compulsions. Well, that's it for another episode of OCD Straight Talk. Feel free to reach out with any questions you might have to chrislines04@gmail.com. If you found the podcast helpful, consider giving it a 5-star rating or subscribing to OCD Straight Talk for structured help with your anxiety or OCD symptoms.